It was getting to be late enough in the winter that even at 80 degrees latitude, the sun rose for an hour or two around noon, and during these brief intervals, the shifting fogs glowed in tones pastel or metallic, on some days violet and rose and pink, on others copper and bronze and gold. And in all cases, the delicate shades of color were captured and reflected by the frost on the ground, so that it looked sometimes as if they traversed a world made entirely of jewels, of amethysts, rubies, sapphires. On other days, the wind would roar, throwing a weight of frost that coated the rover and gave the world a flowing, underwater look. In the brief hours of sunlight, they worked at clearing the rover's wheels, the sun in the fog, like a patch of yellow lichen. Once, after one of these windstorms had cleared, the fog hood was gone as well, and the land to every horizon was a spectacular complexity of ice flowers. And over the northern horizon of this rumpled diamond field stood a tall, dark cloud pouring up into the sky from some source that appeared to be not far over the horizon. They stopped and dug out one of Nadia's little shelters. Nergal stared out at the dark cloud and looked at the map. "I think it might be the Rayleigh Mohol," he said. "Coyote started up the robot excavators in that one during that first trip I took with him. I wonder if something's come of it." "I've got a little scout rover stashed in the garage here," Nadia said. "You can take that over and have a look if you want. I'd go too, but I need to get back to Gamete. I'm supposed to meet Anne there day after tomorrow. Apparently she's heard about the Congress and wants to ask me some questions." Art expressed an interest in meeting Anne Claiborne. He had been impressed by a video about her he had seen on the flight to Mars. It would be like meeting Jeremiah, Jackie said to Nergal. "I'll come with you." So they agreed to meet in Gamete, and Art and Nadia headed there directly in the big rover, while Nergal took off with Jackie in Nadia's scout car. The tall cloud still stood over the ice scape ahead of them, a dense pillar of dark gray lobes torn flat in the stratosphere in different directions at different times. As they got closer, it seemed more and more certain that the cloud was pouring up out of the silent planet. And then as they rolled to the edge of one low scarp, they saw that the land in the distance was clear of ice, the ground as rocky as it would be in high summer, but blacker, a nearly pure black rock that was smoking from long orange fissures in its bulbous, pillowy surface. And just beyond the horizon, which here was 6 or 7 kilometers off, the dark cloud was roiling up like a Mohol thermal cloud gone nova, the hot gaseous smoke exploding outward and then tumbling up hastily. Jackie drove their car to the top of the highest hill in the region. From there they could see all the way to the source of the cloud, and it was just as Nergal had guessed the moment he had seen it. The Rayleigh Mohol was now a low hill, black except for its pattern of angry orange cracks. The cloud poured out of a hole in this hill, the smoke dark and dense and roiling. A tongue of rough black rock stretched downhill to the south in their direction, and then off to their right. As they sat in the car silently watching, a big part of the low black hill covering the Mohol tipped over and broke apart, and liquid orange rock ran quickly between the black chunks, sparking and splashing yellow. The intense yellow quickly turned orange and then darkened further. After that, nothing moved but the column of smoke. Over the ventilator and engine hums, they could hear a rumbling basso continuo, punctuated by booms that were timed to sudden explosions of smoke from the vent. The car trembled slightly on its shock absorbers. They stayed on the hill watching, Nergal rapt, Jackie excited and talkative, commenting at length, then going silent as chunks of lava broke away from the hill, releasing more spills of melted rock. When they looked through the car's IR viewer, the hill was a brilliant emerald with blazing white cracks in it, and the tongue of lava licking the plain was bright green. It took about an hour for orange rock to turn black in visible light, but through the IR, the emerald went dark green in about 10 minutes. green pouring up into the world with the white bursting through it. They ate a meal, and as they cleaned their plates, Jackie moved Nergal around the cramped kitchen with her hands, friendly in the way she had been in New Vanuatu, her eyes bright, a small smile on her lips. Nergal knew these signs, and he caressed her as she passed in the small space behind the driver's seats, happy at the renewed intimacy, so rare and so precious. "I'll bet it's warm outside," he said. And her head snapped around as she looked at him, her eyes wide. Without another word, they dressed and got into the lock and held gloved hands as they waited for it to suck and open. When it did, they stepped out of the car and walked across the dry rust rubble, holding hands and squeezing hard, winding around bumps and hollows and chest-high boulders toward the new lava. Each carried a thinsulate pad in his other outside hand. They could have talked, but they didn't. The air pushed at them from time to time, and even through the layers of his walker, Nergal could feel that it was warm. The ground trembled slightly underfoot, and the rumble was distinct, vibrating in his stomach. It was punctuated every few seconds by a dull boom or a sharper, cracking noise. No doubt it was dangerous to be out here. There was a small rounded hill, very like the one their car was parked on, overlooking the tongue of hot lava from a somewhat closer distance, and without consultation they headed for it, climbing its final slope with big steps, always holding hands, gripping hard. From the top of the little hill they could see far over the new black flow and its shifting network of fiery orange cracks. The noise was considerable. It seemed clear that any new lava would run off the other side of the black mass, the downhill side. They were on a high point in the bank of a stream, with an obvious watercourse running left to right as they looked down on it. Of course, a sudden great flood might overwhelm them, but it seemed unlikely, and in any case they were in no more danger here than they had been in the car. All such calculations disappeared as Jackie pulled her hand free of his and began to take off her glove. Nergal did the same, rolling the stretching fabric up until the wrist was exposed and his thumb free. The glove popped off his fingertips. It was about 278 degrees, he reckoned, brisk but not particularly cold. And then a wave of warm air buffeted him, followed by a wave of hot air, perhaps 315 degrees Kelvin, which quickly passed and was followed by the jostling cool air his hand had been exposed to first. As he peeled off his other glove, it became clear that the temperature was all over the place, each knock of the wind distinctly different. Jackie had already unzipped her jacket from her helmet and down the front, and now, as Nergal watched, she pulled it off, baring her upper body. The air struck her, and goose pimples ran over her skin like cat's paws over water. She leaned over to get off her boots, and her air tank lay in the hollow of her spine, her ribs standing out under her skin. Nergal stepped over and pulled her pants down over her bottom. She reached back and pulled him to her and wrestled him to the ground, and they went down together in a tangle, twisting fast to get onto the thinsulate pads. The ground was very chill. They got their clothes off, and she lay back with her air tank above her right shoulder. He lay on her. In the chill air, her body was amazingly warm, radiating heat like the lava, buffets of heat pushing him from below and from the side, the wind airy and cooked, her body pink and muscular, wrapping him hard with arms and legs, startlingly tangible in the sunlight. They bonked. Faceplates. Their helmets were pumping out air hard to compensate for the leaks around shoulders, backs, chests, collarbones. For a time they looked each other in the eye, separated by the double layer of glass, which seemed the only thing keeping them from fusing into one being. The sensation was so powerful it felt dangerous. They bonked and bonked, expressing the desire to fuse, but knowing they were safe. Jackie's eyes had a strange, vibrant border between iris and pupil. The little black round windows were deeper than any mohole, a drop to the center of the universe. He had to look away. He had to. He lifted off her to look at her long body, which, stunning as it was still less stunning than the depths of her eyes. Wide, rangy shoulders, oval navel, The so feminine length of her thighs, he closed his eyes, he had to. The ground trembled under them, moving with Jackie so that it felt as if he were plunging into the planet itself, a wild, muscular female body. He could lie perfectly still. They both lay perfectly still. And still the world vibrated them in a gentle but intense seismic ravishment. This living rock. As his nerves and skin began to thrum and sing, he turned his head to look out at the flowing magma, and then everything was coming together. They left the Rayleigh volcano and rolled back down into the fog hood's darkness. On the second night after leaving Rayleigh, they approached Gamete. In the dark gray of an especially thick noon twilight, they came up and under the great overhang of ice, and suddenly Jackie leaned forward with a cry and slapped off the autopilot, then kicked down the brake. Nergal had been dozing, and he caught himself on his steering wheel, staring out to see what the trouble was. The cliff where the garage had been was shattered. A great icefall spilled away from the cliff, covering where the garage had been. The ice at the top of the break was heavily starred as by explosion. "Oh!" Jackie cried. "They've blown it up! They've killed them all!" Nergal felt as if he had been punched in the stomach. He was amazed to find what a physical blow fear could wield. In his mind he was numb and seemed to feel nothing, no anguish, no despair, nothing. He reached out and squeezed Jackie's shoulder. She was shaking and peered anxiously through the thick blowing mist. "There's the bolt hole," he said. "They wouldn't have been caught unawares." The tunnel led through an arm of the polar cap to Chasma Austral, where there was a shelter in the ice wall. "But," Jackie said and swallowed, "but if they didn't get any warning..." "Let's get around to the shelter in Austral," Nergal said, taking over the controls. He bounced them over the ice flowers at the car's top speed, concentrating on the terrain and trying not to think. He didn't want to get to the other shelter, get there and find it empty, taking away his last hope, the only way he had of staving off disaster. He wanted never to arrive, to keep driving clockwise around the polar cap forever, no matter the torque of apprehension that was causing Jackie to hiss as she breathed and to moan from time to time. In Nergal, it was only a numbness, an inability to think. "I don't feel a thing," he thought wonderingly. But unbidden images of Hiroko kept flashing before him as if projected on the windshield or standing ghost-like out in the driving mists. There was a chance that the assault had come from space or by missile from the north, in which case there might not have been any warning. Wiping the green world out of the universe and leaving only the white world of death. The colors drained from everything as in this gray fog winter world. He pursed his lips and concentrated on the ice scape, driving with a ruthless touch he hadn't known he had. The hours passed, and he did his best not to think of Hiroko or Nadia or Art or Sax or Maya or Dao or any of the rest. His family, neighborhood, town and nation all under that one small dome. He bent over his twisted stomach and focused on the world of driving, on each little bump and hollow to be dodged in the vain attempt to make it a less rattled ride. They had to go clockwise for 300 kilometers, and then most of the way up the length of Chasma Austral, which in late winter narrowed and became so choked with ice blocks that there was only a single route through, marked by weak little directional transponders. There he was forced to slow down, but under the dark mist they could drive at all hours, and they did so until they reached the low wall that marked the refuge. It was just 14 hours after their departure from the gate of Gamete, an accomplishment over such jagged, frosty terrain, but Nergal didn't even note it. If the refuge was empty... If it was empty... The numbness in him was eroding fast as they approached the low wall at the head of the chasm. There was no sign of anyone or anything there. and his fear was breaking through the numbness like orange magma out of the cracks in black lava. It gushed out and billowed through him, became an unbearable ripping tension in every cell of him. Then a light flickered from low on the wall, and Jackie cried, "Ah!" as if stuck with a pin. Nergal accelerated, and the car bounded toward the ice wall. He almost crashed the car right into it. He slammed on the brakes, and the big wire wheels of the car skidded very briefly, then ground to a halt. Jackie popped on her helmet and dashed into the lock, and Nergal followed, and after an agonizing suck and pump, they dropped out of the lock onto the ground and hurried to the locked door in a shallow recess in the ice. The door opened, and four suited figures leaped out, holding guns. Jackie cried out over the common band, and in a second the four were hugging them. So far, so good, although it was conceivable that they were just comforting them, and Nergal was still in an agony of suspense when he saw Nadia's face behind one of the faceplates. She gave him the thumbs-up sign, and he realized that he had been holding his breath for what seemed like the last 15 hours entire, though no doubt it was only since he had jumped out of the car. Jackie was crying with relief, and Nergal felt that he wanted to cry too, but the sudden disintegration of the numbness and then the fear had left him merely shattered, exhausted, beyond tears. Nadia led him into the refuge lock by hand as if she understood this, and when the lock was closed and pumping up, Nergal began to understand the voices on the common band. "I was so scared I thought you were dead. We got out the escape tunnel. We saw them coming." Inside the shelter, they took off their helmets and went through 100 rounds of embracing. Art slapped him on the back, his eyes popping out like eggs. "So glad to see you two." He pulled Jackie into a rough hug, then held her out at arm's length and looked at her wet, snotty, red-eyed, girlish face with approval and admiration, as if just this moment accepting that she was human, too, and not some feline goddess. As they staggered down the narrow tunnel to the refuge's rooms, Nadia told them the story, scowling as she recalled it. "We saw them coming and got way up the back tunnel and then brought down both domes and all the tunnels. So we may have killed a good number of them, but I don't know. I don't know how many they sent in or how far they got. Coyote's out shadowing them to see if he can tell. Anyway, it's done." At the end of the tunnel was a crowded refuge of several little chambers, roughly walled, floored and ceiling by insulation panels, set right against cavities in the ice. Every room radiated from a larger central chamber that served as kitchen and dining hall. Jackie hugged everyone in there but Maya, ending with Nergal. They held each other hard, and Nergal felt her trembling and realized he was trembling as well in a kind of synchronic vibration. The silent, desperate, fearful drive would strengthen the bond as much as their lovemaking by the volcano, or more. It was hard to tell. He was too tired to be able to read the powerful, vague emotions sloshing through him. He disengaged from Jackie and sat, feeling suddenly exhausted to tears. Hiroko sat beside him, and he listened to her as she told him what had happened in more detail. The attack had started with the sudden appearance of several space planes dropping onto the flat outside the hangar in a group. So they had had very little warning inside, and the people at the hangar had reacted in confusion, telephoning in to warn the others, but failing to activate Coyote's defense system, which apparently they had simply forgotten. Coyote was disgusted about this, Hiroko said, and Nergal could well believe it. "You have to stop paratrooper attacks at the very moment of landing," he said. Instead, the people at the hangar had retreated into the dome. After some confusion, they had gotten everyone up into the escape tunnel, and once they were past the blast point, Hiroko had ordered them to use the Swiss defense and bring down the dome, and Kasei and Dao had obeyed her. And so the whole dome had been blown down, killing whatever part of the attack force was inside, burying them in millions of tons of dry ice. Radiation readings seemed to indicate that the Rickover hadn't suffered a meltdown, although it certainly had been crushed along with everything else. Coyote had disappeared down a side tunnel with Peter, out a bolt hole of his own, and Hiroko didn't know exactly where they had gone. "But I think those space planes may be in trouble." So gamete was gone, and the shell of zygote, too. In some future age the polar cap would sublime away and reveal their flattened remnants, Nergal thought absently. But for now it was buried, utterly unreachable. And here they were. They had gotten out with only some AIs and the walkers on their backs, and now they were at war with the Transitional Authority, presumably, with some part of the force that had assaulted them still out there. "Who were they?" Nergal asked. Hiroko shook her head. "We don't know." "Transitional Authority," Coyote said. "But there are a lot of different units in Anta Security, and we need to find out if this is the full Transitional Authority's new policy, or if some unit has gone on a rampage." "What will we do?" Art asked. At first, no one answered. Finally, Hiroko said, "We'll have to ask for shelter. I think Dorsa Brevia has the most room." "What about the Congress?" Art asked, reminded of it by the mention of Dorsa Brevia. "I think we need it now more than ever," Hiroko said. Maya was frowning. "It could be dangerous to congregate," she pointed out. "You've told a lot of people about this." "We had to," Hiroko said. "That's the point of it." She looked around at them all, and even Maya didn't dare contradict her. "Now we have to take the risk." Part 7. What is to be done? The few big buildings in Sabishi were faced with polished stone, picked for colors that were unusual on Mars. Alabaster, jade, malachite, yellow jasper, turquoise, onyx, lapis lazuli. The smaller buildings were wooden. After traveling by night and hiding by day, the visitors found it a pleasure to walk in the sunlight between low wooden buildings, under plane trees and fire maples, through stone gardens and across wide boulevards of street grass, past canals lined by cypress, which occasionally widened into lily-covered ponds, crossed by high arching bridges. They were almost on the equator here, and winter meant nothing. Even at aphelion, hibiscus and rhododendron were flowering, and pine trees and many varieties of bamboo shot high into the warm, breezy air. The ancient Japanese greeted their visitors as old and valued friends. The Sabishi Issei, dressed in copper jumpsuits, went barefoot, and wore long ponytails and many earrings and necklaces. One of them, bald, with a wispy white beard and a deeply wrinkled face, took the visitors on a walk to stretch their legs after their long drives. His name was Kenji, and he had been the first Japanese to step on Mars, though no one remembered that anymore. At the city wall they looked out at enormous boulders balancing on nearby hilltops, carved into one fantastic shape after another. "Have you ever been to the Medusi Fossi?" Kenji only smiled and shook his head. The Kami stones on the hills were honeycombed with rooms and storage spaces, he told them, and along with the Mohole Mound maze they now could house a very great number of people, as many as 20,000, for as long as a year. The visitors nodded. It seemed possible it might become necessary. Kenji took them back to the oldest part of town, where the visitors had been given rooms in the original compound. The rooms were smaller and more spare than most of the town's student apartments, and had a patina of age and use that made them more like nests than rooms. The Issei still slept in some of them. As the visitors walked through these rooms, they didn't look at each other. The contrast between their history and those of the Sabishians was too stark. They stared at the furniture, disturbed, distracted, withdrawn. And after that evening's meal, after a lot of sake had gone down the hatches, one said, "If only we had done something like this." Nanao began to play a bamboo flute. "It was easier for us," Kenji said. "We were all Japanese together. We had a model." "It doesn't seem much like the Japan I remember." "No, but that isn't the true Japan. They took their cups and a few bottles and climbed upstairs to a pavilion on top of a wooden tower next to their compound. Up there they could see the trees and rooftops of the city and the jagged array of boulders standing on the black skysill. It was the last hour of twilight, and except for a wedge of lavender in the west, the sky was a rich midnight blue, liberally flecked with stars. A string of paper lanterns hung in a grove of fire maples below. We are the true Japanese. What you see in Tokyo today is transnational. There is another Japan. We can never go back to that, of course. It was a feudal culture in any case, and had features we cannot accept. But what we do here has its roots in that culture. We are trying to find a new way, a way which rediscovers the old one or reinvents it for this new place. Kasei Nippon. Yes, but not just for Mars, for Japan also, as a model for them, you see, an example of what they can become. And so they drank rice wine under the stars. Nanao played his flute, and down in the park, under the paper lantern, someone laughed. The visitors sat leaning against each other, drinking and thinking. They talked for a while about all the sanctuaries, how different they were, and yet how much they had in common. They got drunk. This Congress is a good idea. The visitors nodded in various degrees of assent. It's just what we need. I mean, we have been getting together to celebrate John's festival for how many years now? And it's been good, very pleasant, very important. We have needed it for our own sakes. But now things are changing fast. We can't pretend to be a cabal. We have to deal with the rest of them. They talked specifics for a while. Attendance at the Congress, security measures, problem issues. Who attacked the egg? The egg? A security team from Burroughs. Subarashi and Armscor have organized what they call a sabotage investigation unit, and they've gotten the transitional authority to bless the operation. They'll be coming south again, no doubt of that. We have almost waited too long. They got the institution, the information, from me? A snort. You should resist thinking you are so important. It doesn't matter anyway. It's the return of the elevator driving all this, and they are building one for Earth as well, and so we had better act. Then, as the stone sake bottles kept going around and emptying, they gave up on such seriousness and talked about the past year, things they had seen in the outback, gossip about mutual acquaintances, new jokes heard. Nanao got out a packet of balloons, and they filled them and tossed them out into the city's night breeze and watched them float down onto the trees and the old habitats. They passed around a canister of nitrous oxide, took breaths, and laughed. The stars made a thick net overhead. One told stories of space, of the asteroid belt. They tried to nick exposed bits of wood with their pocket knives and failed. This Congress will be what we call Nima Washi, preparing the ground. Two stood, arms around each other, and swayed until they had caught their balance, then held out their little cups in a toast. Next year on Olympus. Next year on Olympus, the others repeated, and drank. It was LS-180, M-year 40, when they began to arrive at Dorsa Brevia in small cars and planes from all over the south. A group of Reds and caravan Arabs checked people's credentials in the wasteland approaches, and more Reds and Bogdanovists were stationed in bunkers located all around the Dorsa, armed in case there was any trouble. The Sabashian intelligence experts, however, thought that the conference was unknown in Burroughs or Hellas or Sheffield, and when they explained why they thought so, people tended to relax, for clearly they had penetrated far into the halls of Unta, and indeed throughout the whole structure of transnational power on Mars. That was another advantage to the Demi-Monde. They could work in both directions. When Nadia arrived with Art and Nergal, they were led to their guest quarters in Zaykros, the southernmost segment of the tunnel. Nadia dropped her pack in a little wooden room and wandered the big park, and then through the segments farther north, finding old friends and meeting strangers, feeling in a mood of good hope. It was encouraging to see all these people milling about the green parks and pavilions, representing so many different groups. She looked around at the crowd thronging the canalside park, perhaps 300 people in view at that moment, and laughed. The Swiss from Overhangs arrived on the day before the conference was supposed to begin. People said they had been camped outside in their rovers, waiting for the date specified. They brought with them a whole set of procedures and protocols for the meeting, and as Nadia and Art listened to a Swiss woman describing their plans, Art elbowed Nadia and whispered, "We've created a monster." "No, no," Nadia whispered back, happy as she looked over the big central park in the third from the south segment of the tunnel called Leto. The skylight overhead was a long bronze crack in the dark roof, and morning light filled the giant cylindrical chamber with the kind of photon rain she had been craving all winter, brown light everywhere. The bamboo and pine and cypress rising over the tile rooftops and blazing like green water. "We need a structure, or it would be a free-for-all. The Swiss are form without content, if you see what I mean." Art nodded. He was very quick, sometimes even hard to understand, because he jumped 5 or 6 steps at a time and assumed she had followed him. "Just get them to drink kava with the anarchists," he muttered, and got up to walk around the edges of the meeting. And in fact that night, on her way with Maya through Gornia to a canalside row of open-air kitchens, Nadia passed by Art and saw that he was doing just that, dragging Mikhail and some of the other Bogdanovist hardliners over to a table of Swiss, where Jürgen and Max and Sibylla and Prishka were chatting happily with a group standing around them, switching languages as if they were translation AIs, but in every language exhibiting the same buoyant, guttural Swiss accent. "Art is an optimist," Nadia said to Maya as they walked on.
"Art is an idiot," Maya replied.
By now there were about 500 visitors in the long sanctuary, representing about 50 groups. The Congress was about to begin the following morning, so on this night the partying was loud, from Zaykros to Phalasarna. The timeslip filled with wild shouting and singing, Arab ululations harmonizing with yodels, the strains of waltzing Matilda forming a descant to the Marseillaise. Nadia got up early the next morning. She found Art already out at the pavilion in Zaykros Park, rearranging chairs into a circular formation in classic Bogdanovist style. Nadia felt a prick of pain and regret, as if Arkady's ghost had walked through her. He would have loved this meeting. It was just what he had often called for. She went to help Art. "You're up early."
"I woke up and couldn't fall back asleep."
He needed a shave.
"I'm nervous."
She laughed. "This is going to take weeks, Art. You know that."
"Yes, but starts are important."
By 10, all the seats were filled, and behind the chairs, the pavilion was crowded with standing observers. Nadia stood at the back of the zygote wedge of the circle, watching curiously. There appeared to be slightly more men than women in attendance, and slightly more natives than emigrants. Most people wore standard one-piece jumpers. The reds were rust-colored, but a significant number were dressed in a colorful array of ceremonial styles: robes, dresses, pantaloons, suits, embroidered shirts, bare chests, a lot of necklaces and earrings, and other jewelry. All the Bogdanovists wore jewelry containing pieces of fovacite, the black chunks shining where they had been cut flat and polished. The Swiss stood in the center, somber in gray banker's suits, Sibylla and Prishka in dark green dresses. Sibylla called the meeting to order, and she and the rest of the Swiss alternated as they explained in excruciating detail the program they had worked out, pausing to answer questions and asking for comments at every change of speaker. As they did this, a group of Sufis in pure white shirts and pantaloons worked their way around the outer perimeter of the circle, passing out jugs of water and bamboo cups, moving with their customary dance-like grace. When everyone had cups, the delegates at the front of each group poured water for the party on their left, and then they all drank. Out in the crowd of spectators, the Vanuatuans were at a table filling tiny cups of kava or coffee or tea, and Art was passing these out to those who wanted them. Nadia smiled at the sight of him shambling through the crowds like a Sufi in slow motion, sipping from the cups of kava he was distributing. The Swiss's program was to begin with a series of workshops on specific topics and problems, working in open rooms scattered through Zaykros, Gornia, Leto, and Malia. All of the workshops were to be recorded. Conclusions, recommendations, and questions from the workshops were to serve as the basis for a subsequent day's discussion at one of the two general ongoing meetings. One of these would focus roughly on the problems of achieving independence, the other on what came after, the means and ends meetings, as Art noted when he stopped briefly at Nadia's side. When the Swiss were done describing the program, they were ready to start. It hadn't occurred to them to have any ceremonial opening. Werner, speaking last, reminded people that the first workshops would begin in an hour, and that was that. They were done. But before the crowd dispersed, Hiroko stood at the back of the zygote crowd and walked slowly into the center of the circle. She wore a bamboo green jumper and no jewelry, a tall, slight figure, white-haired, unprepossessing, and yet every eye there was locked onto her. And when she lifted her hands, everyone seated got to their feet. In the silence that followed, Nadia's breath caught in her throat. "We should stop now," she thought. "No meetings. This is it right here. Our presence together. Our shared reverence for this single person." "We are children of Earth," Hiroko said, loud enough for all to hear. "And yet here we stand, in a lava tunnel on the planet Mars. We should not forget how strange a fate that is. Life, anywhere, is an enigma and a precious miracle. But here we see even better its sacred power. Let's remember that now, and make our work our worship." She spread her hands wide, and her closest associates walked humming into the center of the circle. Others followed suit until the space around the Swiss was full of a milling horde of friends, acquaintances, strangers.
This ends side 2 of cassette 11 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 12.